Good morning, everybody. So we're going to be talking about perennials on cut flower farms. I'm Maggie from Turtle Creek Flowers, previously known as Greenlight Farm. I'm going to give a little bit of an intro to myself, intro to the farm, and then we'll get into talking about perennials. So kind of my history getting into farming. I grew up in rural Ohio, about halfway between Cleveland and Columbus. I did not grow up on a farm. I'm a first-generation farmer. I had my first experience working on a farm in 2011. I worked on a sweet corn agritourism farm kind of just had that feeling of this is it. So I kept farming since then. I spent some time volunteering on farms through WOOF, Worldwide Opportunities on Organic Farms, on a few different small-scale organic vegetable farms. Then I got a paid job on a larger scale, conventional, mostly vegetable, but also a little bit of flower farm, which is in the top right photo there. I kind of, at this point, was really interested in farming, wanting to pursue farming as a career, but I didn't know where I wanted to farm, what I wanted to farm, what scale I wanted to farm, so I was just really in a phase of wanting to learn how lots of different farmers were doing lots of different things in different areas. I was really focused on vegetables at the time. I thought I wanted to grow vegetables in the future, but I had a little bit of experience working with flowers and really, really just fell in love with them and enjoyed that experience. But I was really focused on food at the time. In 2014, I moved to Wisconsin where I got a job on an organic vegetable farm. It's no longer in operation now, but seed-to-seed farm. Which was about 10-acre organic vegetable farm, mostly focused on wholesale production. So I worked there for two seasons in 2014 and 2015. I also worked for a winter at Foxtail Farm, which was an organic CSA farm also in Wisconsin. They had originally a summer CSA and then eventually a winter CSA, so I worked there for one winter as well. And in the second season that I was at Seed to Seed Farm, I had a really small trial bed of flowers where I just kind of experimented very small scale with a few different flower crops. I sold to a local restaurant. At the time, still was more focused on vegetable production, but thought that I was going to grow flowers more of as a side project, side passion. And in 2015, I was actively seeking land. I knew at this point I wanted to farm in Wisconsin. So in fall of 2015, ended up moving to and purchasing my farm. So 2016 up till now, 2016 was the first growing season of what was then Greenlight Farm. In the first year, we planted just about an acre of mostly vegetables with a little bit of flowers, but it became pretty quickly clear that flowers were the right path in terms of both economic niche and also just kind of where the interest lies. Looking back on this picture, I was extremely proud of these market bouquets that I was making, which I kind of cringe at now, of these like haphazardly thrown together, like way too many flowers in a bouquet and like no organization or like theme whatsoever shoved into a 5-gallon bucket. I was very proud of them then and also growing vegetables then. Things have progressed a lot since then. Some pictures from more recent years. Starting in 2017, the farm switched to having solely a flower focus and has been a flower farm solely since then. When the farm started in 2016, I was running the farm with a partner. And then in 2020, we separated and I went through the process of becoming the sole owner operator of the farm. And then after going through two seasons that way, in the end of the last season, kind of decided the farm had just evolved so much since the beginning and just changed so much that it was time for a new name. So changed from Greenlight Farm to Turtle Creek Flowers. And so this will be the first season officially as a full season of Turtle Creek Flowers. Just a little bit about the farm property. We're located in Prairie Farm, Wisconsin. So we're in northwestern Wisconsin. You can see on the map here, we're about a little over an hour northwest of Eau Claire and about an hour and a half, hour 45 minutes from the Twin Cities. The property is 120 acres. We're also surrounded on two sides by 1,000 acres of county forest land. So it's a really kind of secluded, very biodiverse property. About half of the property is forest. That's in the managed forest land program. We have a pasture that we rent out to a local farmer that does beef. We also have a hay field that's rented out to our dairy farming neighbors up the hill. And then our crop field is about 8 acres fenced in with a woven wire deer fence. And we are in zone 4A. But because we're down in a valley, cold air settles. We're very frequently, well, almost always colder than our neighbors up the hill. So even though we're zone 4A, it kind of, it feels more like zone 3. And that comes into play when thinking about perennial plantings and what we can grow in our field. At the time that we bought the property, our crop field had been in the conventional corn and bean rotation for many years. So we did a lot of work in converting that to what it is now. So the last few years, we've had about 4 acres actively in production. And now it's about half annual, half perennial production. In the first couple of years, we only grew about 1 acre, and we had the rest of the field in cover crops. When we bought it, I said it was in a conventional corn and bean rotation for many years. So it was corn stubble the first year that we were growing on it. So we grew our 1 acre of vegetables and flowers, and the rest was in cover crops. We did mostly oats and peas, but we planted some sunflowers and some other things just to sort of get that soil where we wanted it. Because we have more space than we need, we also rotated every year. We've actually, to this point still now, never planted our field annuals in the same place 2 years in a row. We rotate them every year because we have that extra space. But about 4 acres in production, now about half annual, half perennial. We had, at peak of production, 9 greenhouses, hoop houses. We're now down to 5. We are not certified organic, but we've been growing organically since the beginning, have never used any chemical fertilizers, pesticides, herbicides of any kind. There's not really any financial incentive for us to become certified organic. It really wouldn't do anything for the price we can get for our flowers. So, and the customers that we have that care about that are happy with just knowing that we're being honest about and very transparent about the way that we're growing flowers. So we probably will never become certified organic, but we do grow organically. And this year, probably we'll have closer to 3 acres in production. The plan from the beginning, or from at least a couple years in, was always, once we started planting more perennials, was to eventually become less reliant on annual production and more reliant on perennial production. So as that's now coming into fruition, we're decreasing our annual growing space. So this year it's probably going to be more like 3 acres in production, with 2 in perennial and 1 in annual, with the annual production being really focused on high intensity, high value crops that we're growing under plastic with very little outdoor field annual production. Question. Thank you. I was going to say, by the way, to ask questions anytime you want. The question was, how many customers do we have that care about us, about our growing methods? So we sell through the Twin. I'll talk more about our customers in a minute. But we sell through the Twin Cities Flower Exchange, which is a local only chemical free wholesale market. So we have to be chemical free for that customer. But they don't care about any certification. We've sold at various farmers markets throughout the years, and people will sometimes ask about our production methods, but to be honest, not very often. I don't know if, I mean, maybe once or twice throughout an entire season of farmers market will anybody ask, do we grow organically? It just, people aren't really thinking about that as much with flowers as they would be with food. We, for many years, sold to a lot of individual florists, and none of them ever asked. And even when we first started approaching florists about selling to them, we thought, oh, we'll really tell them how we're growing organically. And some of them actually didn't even want to tell their customers that, because they worried that their customers would have fear of bugs and things being wrong with the flowers. So not very many customers are caring about our production methods. I wish they would more. So this is the people that make everything happen on the farm. Of the 4 of us here, 3 are in the room right now. Anybody here who has a farm and has employees, if anybody has returning employees, you know the magic of going season to season with consistency and people you can rely on who have complementary personalities and skill sets. And I've been very lucky that everybody's in their either third or fourth season on the farm now. So this is the team. So our markets, I mentioned we sell wholesale through the Twin Cities Flower Exchange. For several years, the business was really focused on selling to individual florists. We had a delivery route with a van where we sold to florists throughout Wisconsin and the Twin Cities area. But in the last couple years, we really increased our sales through the Twin Cities Flower Exchange and decided last year to do all of our wholesaling through them instead of having our own individual wholesale customers plus wholesaling through them. That's been really good for us and for the business. We also sell at Mill City Farmers Market in Minneapolis. That's probably the place where customers would care most about our production methods, but all of the farmers that sell there are growing organically or sustainably, so I think customers there just assume for the most part. We have a focus in selling at the farmers market in the spring with tulips. Tulips are probably the individual crop that we're most known for. We grow 20,000 tulips a year, which we grow as annuals. And so we hit those like Mother's Day markets and those early spring markets with those. We also do mixed bouquets throughout the season that we sell at local businesses, coffee shops, boutiques, things like that in our local area in western Wisconsin. We dry flowers throughout the season that we sell locally, and also we have an online store where we ship dried flowers across the continental U.S. And then we don't do any full service wedding design of any kind. We don't do anything more complicated design wise than market bouquets. But we do DIY bulk buckets. And then this year, a new thing is we're going to be in the 4 to 5 acres that's unused in any given year in our crop field. We're going to have that planted in sunflowers and be open to the public for people to come take pictures. It's the first time in a couple of years we've been open to the public in any capacity, and the first time that we'll be open to the public in this kind of capacity, but something we're really excited for. So if you're in the area in late summer or early fall, come see us, come see the sunflowers. So perennials. So we established our perennial field. Most of our perennials, we're still planting perennials probably well every year, but we established our perennial growing section of our field in 2018, so our third growing season. And when we were first starting out, we heard the advice of the best time to plant perennials is yesterday, plant them now, plant them right away. I don't know that I would necessarily give that advice to somebody. I guess it depends, which actually I'm gonna pause here for a second. I was gonna do this at the beginning. I'm just curious to know who I'm talking to here. Show of hands, is anybody here who's actively already growing or working on a farm that grows flowers? Okay, so there's a lot of flower people in the room. Anybody growing vegetables or fruit or some other crop and looking to add on perennials? Okay, awesome. So we got the advice of plant perennials now, plant them yesterday, plant them now. So we did plant some perennials in those first couple years, 2016, 2017. None of them are alive anymore for various reasons. We planted the wrong things. We planted the wrong quantities. We planted them in the wrong place. They weren't good cut flowers. We were just figuring. Also, we had a tornado in 2017, which messed up a lot of things. So, but a lot of factors. But every perennial we planted in those first couple years no longer exists. We were just sort of figuring out getting to know our land, getting to know our soil, getting to know like the logistics of our pathways and how do we move around and like what's our systems. So it really wasn't until 2018 that things kind of fell into place. 2018 was kind of the year that we started to scale things up, added more hoop houses. It was the first year that the farm was profitable, and we just sort of were more organized in our systems and more confident in our ability to grow flowers for a longer term. So it seemed like a good time to make a pretty big investment in perennials. So also in 2018, so one challenge we've continually had and have less now on the farm, because we are in a valley, we have pretty heavy, more clay soils for the most part. In the spring, when the snow melts, and also anytime there's a big rain event, we have a lot of challenges dealing with water. So we had a lot of like flooding events, a lot of washout in the first couple of years. And some ways that we dealt with that were now we're mostly no-till, we're very low-till. So just not having loose soil as much as we can avoid that. We also implemented raised beds in all of our hoop houses and just became more aware of where we should and where we should not plant things and different things that should or should not be planted in different places. We also got a grant from the NRCS that year to do a waterway, water diversion. So we, in the top left photo, you can sort of see like there's straw. So we had, we now have a waterway that cuts through the hay field, goes all the way down our field, and collects a lot of that excess water. And it also created a sort of natural division almost exactly halfway through our crop field. So it so now we have our annuals, our hoop houses, and our annual production on one side and our perennial production on the other side. And that just kind of makes sense and makes things more efficient in terms of the layout of everything. So here's some photos of 2018, 2019 when we were just starting to plant a lot of things. We were mostly focusing at that time on like woody cuts, like shrubs. So we did a planting of peony, winterberry, hydrangea, lilac, ninebark, things like that. Here's some photos from the last growing season of some of those same views. We've added a lot to our perennial field, and everything is just really coming into fruition in the last couple of years. So it's been a lot of labors of love and a lot of time commitment, but it was really in 2021 and 2022 that we really started actually cranking out stems from our perennial field. So some reasons why I think growing perennials for flowers is a good idea, and we'll talk more about all these things. Season extension, crop diversity, biodiversity, and pollinator food and habitat, soil health, decreasing time and money on annual plantings, profitability, and the non-tangibles, which as time goes on, I think are more important, beauty, fun, creativity, the fun stuff. So season extension, in general, on a flower farm is very important. I mean, depending on what your business is and what your goals are. For us, the goal from the beginning was always to create a business that would be the primary livelihood and something that could have income all year round. So season extension was really important. And we've also extended our sales season through the hoop houses and through selling dried flowers in the winter. But perennials are also really important for that. You know, in the world of vegetables, you have your radishes or salad greens or things that you can plant that are relatively easy to grow that you can have a crop in 30 days and many successions of. In the world of flowers, especially annual flowers, you really don't have those super, super quick turnaround crops. So if you're relying on just growing annuals from seed, your growing season is going to be very short, and there's so much pressure then on those summer months. It's the intensity of harvesting all you can from those summer annuals. So just some examples of things that we have in the spring and the fall. In the spring, the first thing that we're harvesting, usually in March or April, is pussy willows. We don't sell those on their own. We choose to save them. We hoard them and pair them with our tulips. But if you wanted to have like a pretty easy to grow early crop, that's an example of like what would be the first thing for us in the spring. Also, peonies in the spring, really useful because they're very popular and there's markets for them. And it's also kind of that early June is kind of a tricky time for like a focal flower if you're making bouquets or doing wedding work or anything like that. Then in the fall, usually how it works for our growing season, we usually wrap up our annual production in kind of mid-October, maybe late October, have some time to do some cleanup work, get our tulips planted, and then in November, we're harvesting dogwood and willow sticks and winterberry, so that's kind of the last thing we do at the end of the season. When you're about to be going into the really lean months of winter, then you can have some extra last of the season product to sell then. Crop diversity. what I'm talking about here is diversity in terms of if you're doing any sort of thing, market with flowers, where you're pairing flowers with other flowers, so you're making market bouquets, or you're doing wedding buckets, or you're doing full service wedding design, just having a diversity of flowers all throughout the season. I would say in 2022, the first year that we really had like every single one of our perennial crops available for harvesting, our bouquet quality just went so much higher. It really peaked, because all throughout the season we had just like an enormous diversity of crops to use in bouquets. And it feels good to have that. So just some examples, like in the bottom left, this kind of like whimsical bouquet. I see milkweed in there, and there's mountain mint in there. Top left, there's our pussy willows that we're pairing with our tulips. The middle photo, the bulk of that bouquet is perennials, peonies, baptisia. The top right photo, when I look at that, my eyes go to those pops of yellow, and that's a perennial flower there. In the bottom here, all these grasses are perennial grasses. So just really gives you a lot of, like if you're just having, grown from seed, summer annuals, you have your zinnias and your cosmos and these sort of like workhorse annual crops. But if you're trying to make a bouquet with just those things, it's just not going to have that little special sauce. So I feel like the perennial crops for us really add those extra like filler crops, just take up space in bouquets, those extra pops of color and texture and smell and just really fun things that if you're selling, especially maybe at farmer's market, that can really draw people in because your bouquets will look a bit different.
So we already have about 20 acres of tall grass prairie. Mm-hmm.
Sure, so question was about prairie flowers and ones that could be used for cuts. I will say that in terms of grasses, so we harvest a lot of weeds on our farm, but we mostly dry them. So we use a lot of just wild grasses that we just dry, and one of our most popular dried flower wreaths that we make is just a native grasses wreath, which has like things like foxtail and a lot of like unwanted weeds, which sort of began as like areas of the farm that just got out of control with weeds, and we didn't know what to do with them. We just started cutting them. But in terms of fresh things, I'm struggling to remember some of the names right now. Like some brome. I'm not sure of the correct pronunciation of that. Those work really well for us for using in fresh bouquets. I have in the handout too, and like later I have a resource list. Prairie Moon Nursery is a really good place that we've gotten, because I'm struggling to remember exact names now, but that's a place where we've gotten all the grasses that we grow intentionally, not just harvesting the weeds. That's where been our source for that. And a lot of the grasses we've grown from that source have been good for both fresh and dried. So I'd recommend looking there for some ideas. Also, foliage in terms of diversity. I don't know if you all feel this way too, but I think that like you never have enough foliage. You always need more foliage. Like I am in the eighth season of growing flowers now, and I still feel like we don't have enough foliage. You just can never ever have enough foliage. And I mean that in terms of like making bouquets or doing wedding work, but also wholesale. We have a big cargo van that we fill up for going to the wholesaler every week. And especially in the last couple of years, it's been about half full of foliage and half full of flowers. So, just relying on annual crops, it's really hard to get enough foliage for whatever your needs are for your markets. So perennials are a really great way to add more foliage. Here is thornless raspberry. This is possibly becoming my favorite crop that we grow in general. It's extremely useful. It's really easy to grow, easy to harvest, holds up well. We grow a thornless variety so you don't get poked. Yes? Question is, where do we source our thornless raspberry? We grow the variety Joan Jay, and we get it from Norse Farms. And I've been buying from them. I have some more ordered to plant this year. I've been buying from them for several years. It's a very pretty quick turnaround crop. When we plant it, we start harvesting from those the same year. It also produces really large, very delicious berries, so you can also have a tasty snack as well. So that's one of our favorites. But we've also just gotten creative. There's quite a bit of things that we maybe planted for the flower that have like a short season when they're flowering, but that the foliage is nice the whole rest of the season, so you can continue to make sales off of that and use those foliages. So perennial is definitely very useful for adding to your foliage crops. So in the lower left is more raspberry again, and then in the lower left, that is either peppermint or spearmint. It's a mint. I also see some mountain mint in there. I think there's some baptisia in that photo too, which baptisia is one that we harvest the flowers in June, but we can harvest from the foliage all season long. So that's a really useful foliage crop as well. So we grow just about everything in landscape fabric, and that kind of the fabric aisleways in between the beds kind of prevent things from spreading. So we haven't had too many. We haven't had any issues with mint taking over, but I know that it definitely can. So biodiversity and pollinator habitat. This is maybe not like a marketable reason for growing perennials, but like close to heart is very important reason that we grow a lot of perennials. We just have throughout the growing season a lot of things blooming from early spring all the way till when things die for the winter. So just anecdotally, we've seen an enormous increase. I mean, in birds and bees and snakes and frogs and things just up and down the food chain since we've started farming. And that's just kind of special to see. That has a lot to do with a lot of things that we've done, changes we've made to the property and the farm. But the having all the perennial plants, especially like the woody shrubs and things that we don't necessarily prune in the fall, there's just a lot of plant matter, a lot of stuff out in our field all winter long, all year round. There's a lot of habitat there. Kind of a passion project that we've had the last couple of years is growing and collecting seed from and planting more milkweed. We've grown like common milkweed, but we mostly grow swamp milkweed because where we're planting it, it's just a very wet section where we can't grow that many other things. So we started growing milkweed. Every year I'm trying to get new varieties of milkweed. We grow them. We do harvest it for the flower. It's a really great, we love it as a cut flower. We sell a lot of it wholesale. We use it in bouquets. But we've been harvesting very small quantities the last couple of years. We're kind of waiting until we have so much of it that we can harvest without thinking about how much we're harvesting and still have a lot for the butterflies and the bees. Yes?
How do you control for milkweed beetles? Do you guys get the red milkweed beetles?
No, I haven't seen them, so. Yes? Oh, sorry, the question was about milkweed beetles and how do we control for them, and we've never had them that I'm aware of. So the yellow flower, that is, it's in the Centuria family. It's in the same plant family as like bachelor buttons. And it blooms in, I want to say, I think July. So kind of that middle of the summer time. It only blooms for a couple of weeks. It smells, it looks like little pineapples and it smells like banana candy. It's a really interesting flower. The milkweed is one big thing that we've been just focusing on expanding our planting of.
What's the white flower?
That's milkweed there. Somebody asked what the white flower was, and that's milkweed. And we grow a few varieties of whites. There's some pinks and purples, some like yellows and some oranges. Somebody else had a hand up, yes. Question was about does that milkweed have that sap, and is there anything that we do to like treat that or deal with that before mixing with other flowers. It does, but not nearly as much as like the thicker, it has a lot thinner stalks than like the common milkweed. So it does, but not that much. And we don't do anything special for it, and we've never gotten any negative feedback from it. So,
where do you get your seed?
I've gotten seeds. I think I've gotten seeds, milkweed seeds from Prairie Moon Nursery. I've also gotten some from, we get a lot of our seeds from Geo Seed. I might have gotten some from Johnny's too. I don't remember for sure. But definitely Geo Seed has like quite a few varieties of milkweed. And we've gotten them. So, question was, when does it bloom? July into August, maybe a little bit too, but kind of that middle of the summertime. Mm-hmm. Some varieties I can think of. There's Cinderella is a good one. Ice Princess. This year I'm trying some new ones. Hello Yellow is one I'm trying this year. Gay Butterflies is one I'm trying this year. That's like a mix of like yellows and oranges and reds. But Ice Princess and Cinderella are the two that we have the most of that have grown really well in the swamp milkweed. Soil health, growing perennials. We've been more and more focused as the years have gone by on doing very minimal till. Just in general on the farm, and that sort of began out of just kind of a need to do that in order to grow crops well where we live with our just the water issues that we have and like the heavier soil. We had a couple of incidents in the first couple of years where we had loose soil that was tilled and then a big rain event, and there's nothing more depressing than just watching your soil wash away, and we just did not want to ever see that again. So we don't till it all in our hoop houses, and now that we're becoming increasingly more reliant on our perennial crops, we're not tilling that whole area of the field because obviously they're perennial crops and we don't need to do anything with the soil there. So just keeping our soil in place. We also have our perennial crops are at the like top, so our field gradually slopes downwards. The perennials are all at the top. So we also then, other crops planted further down the field, we have these perennial crops that now, as the years have gone by, have these really dense, thick root systems that are really holding that soil in place further down the field as well. Yes?
You talk about the struggle of erosion, but I'm really curious to know how you got from point A to point Z and how you got this all established. Did you mm-hmm. have struggles when you were starting that? What was your main biggest success?
Okay, so the question was about dealing with erosion and water issues and how do we get from point A to point B. The waterway that we got the grant for was really, really helpful. It really does make a huge difference in the spring when we have the snow melt. There's just a river going through that waterway now. So that's really helpful. Being mindful of where we should not disturb the soil was really helpful, and just keeping the soil in place in places where it would be vulnerable. Like I said, our perennial crops are like at the top of the field. Also, our hoop houses are at the top of the other side of the field, and we're doing all like raised bed, no-till there too. So that's also like another chunk of our crop field where the soil is not going anywhere. Having that like permanent infrastructure in place now, it's been a few years since we had any sort of like washout. In the first couple of years we were doing a lot of tractor tilling. We tilled up the whole field with the tractor before we planted cover crops, and we were never tilling very intensively. We were never doing any tractor cultivation or in terms of like weeding. But we were tilling at least once, maybe a few times throughout the season. And there's sections of the field that have not been touched with a tractor now since probably 2017. So there's just a lot of soil that just hasn't been disturbed. So I think that's probably been the biggest thing, is just not disturbing the soil. Do you feel like your question was answered? Okay. Question was, where did we get the waterway grant? From the NRCS.
Was that a grant or was it cost share?
A cost share, I believe. But the person that we had do it, the cost of it ended up being, I think, almost 100% covered. I don't think we paid much of anything of our own money for that. Yes. Question was, are perennials in landscape fabric? The answer is yes. I'll talk a little bit more in a couple slides about like different ways that you can plant perennials and why we do things the way that we do, and other ways that you can do things. But yes, all of our perennials are in landscape fabric. So decreasing annual plantings. This, you know, in the springtime, your to-do list just explodes and everything needs to happen all at the same time and everything seems crucial. So anything that we can do to take the pressure off of those spring months seems invaluable. So this is a picture of our annual planting field from a couple of years ago. So I mentioned earlier that we've gone down to, we've been decreasing our annual field production. And because now we have more of these perennials that we're harvesting, and so that for us means less cost of buying seeds, it means less potting soil, it means less fertilizer, it means less time planting seeds, it means being able to delay when we're turning on the LP in our greenhouse for seed starting, it means less time transplanting in the fall, it means less time doing field cleanup. Of course, it doesn't mean that we're like taking a vacation in the spring. There's still, the to-do list is still way longer than it should be, but it feels easier not having the pressure of all the annual work in the spring as much. So that's been really beneficial as well. I'll talk about it later. Okay, so kind of different categories of like thinking about perennials in terms of profitability. The things that the crops that we have the highest value in terms of like dollar per stem that you can get are also often the things that there's the highest demand for, but also the highest production costs. Some examples of those, hydrangea, peony, winterberry. These are three of the most expensive things that we originally planted in terms of the cost of the plants or the roots. And these are all things that we planted in that first planting in the spring of 2018. And this year we probably about came to break even on peonies. It was the first year that we had like a real peony harvest. But I don't think I would say that we've turned a profit on them yet, this year probably. But it takes a few years. You just have to watch them grow very slowly and wait. Hydrangea, we just started harvesting as well. Winterberry, 2022 was the first year that we really harvested that crop too. These are all crops that we're very confident will bring us a profit in the long term significantly, but that we've just been babying for 4 to 5 years with zero return. Yes?
How much would you get per stem for those crops wholesale?
About $3 a stem for each of them, ish. Depends a little bit. You can get more if you're, you know, doing that retail or for wedding design, especially with the peonies and the hydrangeas too, but multiple dollars per stem. Another thing to keep in mind for crops like this that take so low, go ahead.
While we're on high production costs, do you experiment at all with hollyhock?
Question was, do we experiment with hollyhock? No, I have not ever tried to grow hollyhock. Question was if we do any season extension with saving peonies dry in the cooler for later. No, we've just had enough market to just move them right away and haven't had necessarily any reason to save them. I know that you can do that, but we have not. In the back there. So winterberry here and hydrangea are two other expensive ones that were for original plantings. We also planted lilacs that first year. That's a more expensive one. in general, things that are like woody cut, like shrubs, are going to be pretty expensive in the short term to buy the plants and establish them. Another thing that that you don't have the wisdom of until you have a crop 5 years after you've planted crops like this, especially with peonies, is I wish that we had planted a lot more and some different colors of peonies. And now if we do another planting of them, we have to wait another 5 years to have any crop of them. So we have white and pink and yellow peonies. I wish that we had some brighter pinks and some kind of darker, more red colors. And we don't, and I can't have them until minimum 4 to 5 years from now, even if we plant this year. So that's one thing that's kind of, you're kind of, you know, when you're planting annuals, you get a redo every year. And with perennials, you're kind of stuck with what you've planted. The question was, do we split our tubers? We haven't yet. Definitely could eventually, but we have not yet. Question was, do we do any cauterizing with woody cut stems? I've experimented with that with hydrangea because it has problems. Even if you think you're cutting it at exactly the right time, it has problems with drooping. Some of that, because last year was our first year like really having like a significant hydrangea crop. We did some experimenting with just like time of day that we were cutting, the right stage of harvest. That seemed really crucial with hydrangea, just getting the right, not harvesting it too immature. But that is a crop to do that. That seems to be a good idea to do that with.
Where are you getting your hydrangea planted?
The question was, where are we getting our hydrangeas? All of our bushy, woody cuts plants we sourced from Spring Meadow Nursery in Michigan. It's a company you have to have, there's a minimum order, so you kind of have to either be sharing with another farm or having larger plantings for that. But I've been really happy with the quality of and the selection that they have. They have pretty decent wholesale pricing, yes. And peonies, we've gotten the largest peony planting we did was from Oregon Perennials. I've sourced peonies from several different places, and Oregon Perennials, I would say I was the most happy with the price and quality of. So I would probably buy from them again if we're going to do another bigger peony planting. Oh, also annual labor, just like all these years that we were growing these and just like watching them slowly, painfully slowly, not even seem to grow at all, especially the first couple of years. We were also having to weed them, if you're doing irrigation, water them, fertilizing them, all these things, just waiting them, hoping that they eventually make you some money. Question was about irrigation. How do we irrigate our perennials? So we are lucky in this. We don't irrigate anything outside at all, unless it's a severe drought. Because we're in a valley, we have a really high water table, we have heavy soils, we get a lot of like heavy mists, in morning mists, even in the driest part of the summertime. So there's been I think in that first year, 2018, I think we brought a sprinkler out right away when we did some plantings because it was just happened to be, there was some rain supposed to be coming and it didn't come, so we had to do, I think that's the only time I have ever irrigated perennials in all these years is one time right after planting in 2018. That obviously is something that you should be thinking about if you're gonna need to be irrigating. I probably would do some sort of drip system if I was going to be doing irrigating. We use drip for all of our hoop house crops, but we don't irrigate our perennials at all. We did see in 2020, the drought year, we could see signs that some stuff was definitely dry, but everything, and actually to that point too, in 2021 we saw some this sort of like something was happening with some of our peonies. They almost looked like cabbages, like the flowers weren't forming right. And I through some research, was suspecting that that was because of lack of water in 2020 carried over the 2021 season and caused some damage in that crop. So if we ever had a really dry year again, we probably would specifically irrigate the peonies for that purpose for the following year's crop. But in 2022, they were beautiful, and we didn't really see that. So, and then another kind of profitability category, things that have sort of more medium value in terms of like dollar per stem, things that are kind of in the $1 to $1.50-ish range per stem. These are kind of like the workhorse crops, I would say. Things that have kind of medium value, but high demand still, and lower production costs. So here I have mountain mint in the upper left picture there, and just like mints in general, we grow a lot of different types of mint. Mountain mint is definitely my favorite. Really long stems, really nice and bouquets. Easy to grow, easy to cut. Then there's another variety of milkweed. And yarrow, all those are grown from seed, and then the thornless raspberry that I mentioned earlier. The thornless raspberry is more expensive than the other grown from seed crops, but it's still, in terms of like things that we're growing from roots or plants or cuttings, it's on the less expensive side. These are all things that, whether you're planting a plant or growing from seed, that you can start harvesting that crop either that same year or the next year. These are just things that are really reliable sellers, reliable growers, and these are the things that have really given us the income streams that we need while we're waiting on all the other things to start being harvestable. Yes.
Have you had an issue controlling for some of these more aggressive perennials, like mint and yarrow, to kind of keep them from spreading and outcompeting the other perennials?
Question was, have we had problems with these kinds of things spreading out and competing with other crops? No, not really. Because we're planting with the landscape fabric, and we have like pathways that are also landscape fabric in between, it kind of prevents things from spreading out. We have had like yarrow is probably the one I would think of most, that like in the spring when we're doing like our spring weeding in the perennials, we'll see little baby yarrow plants starting to pop up in other places. But when they're young, they're easy to pull out if we don't want them where they're trying to grow. That has not been a problem for us at this point. Say again?
How wide are your path?
It varies a little bit. We have some, it depends, it kind of, in the perennials, it kind of depends on what we're planting and how, what their space requirement is. Like in our annual field, we have 2-foot paths between all of our annual plantings when we use landscape fabric. In the perennial field, we have a little bit wider paths. There's some areas where I wish we would have made the paths even wider, because there's places where we're really crunched when we're moving in between different things. But in general, a couple feet. These are things that you are going to have still some annual labor, still some upfront costs, but that you'll start recouping that faster. Question was, do we stake our peonies or other perennials? No, we never have, and we never have really needed to. We haven't had really too many issues. I think part of it is part of it probably is wind, honestly. We don't really have a lot. We're really protected against wind, being down in this valley with woods all around. In terms of our annual crops, too, the only things that we use any sort of trellising or netting for at all are lisianthus and ornamental kale, I think. I think that's the only thing we use netting for. We haven't had many issues with things blowing over or things like that, because we grow things either under plastic or we're pretty protected from the wind where we are. Here's some examples in terms of profitability of things that have like a lower value and lower demand, but also have lower production costs, quick return, and maybe are just sort of fun. Some examples, this is that yellow perennial in the Centuria family on the top left that looks like pineapples and smells like banana candy and is really fun. Wholesale, we don't really have any market for it. It blooms for just a couple of weeks and we'll stick it in some market bouquets. But it's the kind of crop where, like, if you're selling at farmer's market, people have never seen something like that before, and they will come up and ask you a question, and you can tell them to smell it, and then you're engaging with them, and then they buy your flowers. So Things like that are just sort of useful conversation pieces, and easy to grow. It's a really easy to grow flower as well. So we like to keep that one around. Also, the bees really like it. On the top right, this is Penstemon in the Digitalis family. It produces these really lovely, kind of dainty, very pretty flowers. We stopped harvesting it in the flowering stage because, like, if there's a rain, the flowers get really bruised really easily. We just had some quality issues with it, and it just didn't really hold up that well. But if you let it keep flowering, it produces like really dark, like burgundy seed pods, and they hold on the plant for the rest of the season. So we sell a couple bunches a week of this in the seed pod stage. It also just looks really gorgeous in like a mass planting if you're just looking for something that looks pretty. The bees absolutely love it. Penstemon. And this one I think we got from Prairie Moon Nursery is another one we got from that source as well. On the bottom right, Liatris is another one. It's kind of a favorite of, it's a favorite of us on the farm. We just like the way it looks. Some of the stems grow like weird and curvy and just like are fun to look at. The bees and butterflies also really like it. We will use it in bouquets sometimes or sell a little bit wholesale. Not a whole lot of demand for it. Nobody's really excited about this flower. But we really like it. It's a gorgeous purple color. It dries really nicely, so we'll sometimes use it in dried arrangements or dried flower wreaths. And it also just looks really gorgeous in a mass planting, so we like it. The only perennial crop I can think of that I wish that I had planted less of is dogwood and willows. But even that, I'm like trying to be creative in not regretting planting so much of it. So if anybody has grown dogwood or willow, you know that it grows really quickly, really easily. So we planted a small amount of that the first year that we planted perennials, and then we learned, hey, this is really cool. We can like cut this into little pieces and propagate it, and it just grows great. So we planted way too much of it, and it grows really fast, and you have to maintain it every year. This is something that you have to cut basically almost down to the ground every year, or else it becomes, what I've learned from experience, a tree in like 2 years, and it's really hard to get rid of, and you have to cut it down with a chainsaw, and you can tell I've gone through this. Yes?
What are your preferred varieties of willow and dogwood?
I've mostly planted, so if I was going to do this again, and I was going to grow, so pussy willow is great. Like we could maybe even do some propagating of that and plant more of that. There's demand for that. Like we haven't even tried to sell it individually because we hoard it to use with our tulips, but love pussy willows. There's a lot of different like sizes and like colors that you can get of those. Those are great. In terms of these other willows that we grow that we're growing for the sticks, if I was doing it again, I'd do a much smaller planting of a lot of different colors. There's some really cool colors you can get for harvesting in like mid-November kind of is when they really color up for us. So like the ones we have are kind of like yellow orange, but there's like white ones and green ones and black ones and lots of different colors. So if I was doing it again, I would get like a smaller amount of like a lot of different colors. There's also, so we planted way too much of this and now we have to like figure out how to deal with it. So we started, the primary thing that we do with our willow sticks now is that we use them to make our bases for our dried flower wreaths. And that's been really useful. And but still, that's not enough to cut and use all of what we have. So like I've given some. I have a friend who raises goats, and she took a bunch to make cuttings to make like a living fence out of it. So like that's pretty cool. You could do things like that. You could weave baskets from it. Lots of fun things you can do with willow. What else have we done with willow? I heat my house with a wood stove. It makes really good kindling if you dry it out. So in the springtime, if I have some left that I haven't used or pruned down yet, I'll just cut it all down and I throw it in a pile, and then I use that for my next year's kindling pile. Somebody had a question? Yes, we use, so the question was, can we use them as wreath bases? Yes, that we do. We do use them as wreath bases. They're really easy to work with and bend into using for wreath bases.
Have you tried corkscrew willow?
Question was, have we tried corkscrew willow? No, but that's a fun one, and that, yeah, would recommend. I've seen it, other people locally who grow it, and yeah.
What's your favorite your base wreath size, and then how long of a stick are you using to do your weaving?
Question was, what's our base wreath base size, and how long of sticks are we using? We try to do about 10 to 12 inch wreath bases. That just seems to be like a nice wreath size. The boxes that we ship them in are 18 by 18, and if we have about a 12 inch base and then we're adding the flowers onto it, that's about the right size to fit in the 18 by 18 inch boxes. So that's the size we use. They're really tall, like taller than me, and we have to cut them down low to prune them anyway. So usually if I'm making a wreath, I'll start with like a mid-sized, medium diameter, really long one to make the first like circle, and then just add in whatever size to strengthen it. And I usually use like minimum 3 sticks per wreath base to make sure that it's not gonna pop apart. She asked if I could repeat the names of the purple flowers. This is Penstemon up top. It's in the Digitalis family. And then Liatris on the bottom. Okay. Okay, I think that's all I have to say about willow and dogwood. So just things to consider when you're planting perennials. Your growing zone, so I mentioned I'm in zone 4A, but I try to plant things that are supposed to be hardy down to zone 3 because there's been several things that are supposed to be hardy down to zone 4 that just haven't made it in my field just because it's really cold and it takes forever for the snow to melt and for the ground to thaw in the spring, and it's just cold throughout. Colder than it would be if we were up on the uphill. Just knowing your growing zone and also your own microclimate. And then location, I'm sort of talking about, like, when I'm talking about location, like soil type, accessibility, irrigation, all these things kind of in terms of location. So, like, on our farm, most of our soil is kind of heavier, wet soil, but we do have a small section that's more sandy, and then a small section that's kind of like silty loam, and then the rest is sort of heavier, more clay soil. So just being really mindful and trying as much as you can to think strategically long term about like what you think you're going to plant and like how much of it you're going to want to plant. Are you going to want to eventually propagate if you have, you know, a patch of something? Are you going to want to eventually dig up and propagate and add to that? And are you going to leave space for that or put it somewhere else? Like things like that. Like, you know, you could have like, we have like a couple different sections, for example, of like milkweed and a couple different sections of yarrow, and they're kind of far apart from each other. And like then when we're harvesting those things, we want to harvest all the yarrow, we have to start here and then load up and then go down there and do it down there. And it's like these things that like are small logistical things, but that can make a huge difference in the efficiency when you're eventually harvesting these crops. It's hard to think 5-10 years down the road, but as much as you can be thinking about those things. Also, just accessibility. One thing that I wish we would have done is put more pathways in our perennial field when we're doing like weeding, when we're doing harvesting, when we're doing any of these things where we're getting in and out of spaces. I wish we would have been more mindful in making easier pathways, especially for weeding. We end up having to like haul buckets or wheel or carts or whatever, like. Or even when we're harvesting, we're doing more walking than I think we should. And we would save a lot of time in the long run if I'd put more pathways in the perennial field. So be thinking about that, whether, you know, if you're using whatever harvest vehicle or whatever your systems are for weeding or harvesting or how you're moving in and out of spaces, just trying to be mindful of making that more efficient for yourself and saving time and also saving energy in like your body and labor. Irrigation, I mentioned that we don't have to irrigate really much at all on our farm, but obviously be thinking about that if you are going to be irrigating. What's your system going to be for that? Sprinklers, hoses, drip tape, just where's your water source, all those kinds of things. So landscape fabric versus other types of mulching or grassy pathways. We do use landscape fabric for all of our perennial plantings. As of this moment, I would say that that was still the right choice for us, and I do not regret it. There's going to be benefits and drawbacks to any sort of thing that you're doing with that. Now, like if I was doing this perennial planting now, like I might consider using grassy pathways because now I have a really nice zero turn mower, but I didn't then. And I am just very confident that if we had not planted things in landscape fabric, the weeds would have taken over and we would have died because I'm just not confident enough that I would have been able to keep that area under control.
Do you replace your landscape fabric every year?
Question was, do we replace the landscape fabric? No. We do not use any single annual use plastic, like really of any kind. So our seeding trays, our landscape fabric, these are all, everything that's plastic is all stuff that we're reusing. So this original patch of landscape fabric in our very first perennial planting is still there. And as of this point, the weeds aren't growing up in it. It's doing fine. I don't know what will happen 5 years from now, 10 years from now. But we still are, and in our annual plantings too, we also use landscape fabric, and we've been using the same landscape fabric since the beginning, so we reuse that every year too.
Do you have any problems with pests under the plastic, or getting any crops or anything?
Question was, do we have problems with pests getting under the landscape fabric? No, I don't think so. I haven't experienced that. The one significant drawback that has been a problem that I would say to be aware of if you're growing perennials is just keeping the landscape fabric as clean as you can, removing like dirt. If you're pulling out big weeds and you have root balls that are putting dirt, just like not leaving significant clumps of dirt or debris on the landscape fabric, weed seeds will find their way into that and grow. So just keeping things like cleaner. And also there's been a couple, like I mentioned that we had tried to grow a couple of things that didn't end up being hardy enough to grow. So we have a couple of small sections in like the very first perennial field where we had planted something but then it died. And if you don't immediately, like pretty quickly plant something else there or put a tarp down or something, you'll get just gigantic perennial weeds that will come up. And it's really a pain in the butt, so try not to let that happen. Another thing that I could anticipate a negative in terms of landscape fabric for the future is if someday we are trying to, for example, like dig up and divide things like peonies, that might be a situation where then we probably would just take off that landscape fabric completely and redo it after that because we'd be causing so much disturbance. So that could be something to anticipate for the future. But as of now, the landscape fabric works for us, and I'm happy with it. And even one thing I worried about was just like what we're doing to the soil or like the biodiversity or all these things. Honestly, what I've seen from what we can see underneath the landscape fabric is there's a lot of activity of like worms and bugs and stuff happening under that landscape fabric. Snakes really love living in that heat. And I don't know, just from what I've seen, I don't see any significant drawbacks at this point in us using the landscape fabric.
So with your annual crops, do you pull up the landscape fabric at the end of the season, or do you leave it?
Question was, with our annual crops, do we leave the landscape fabric or pull it up? We pull it up every year. Mm-hmm. And if you are growing with landscape fabric for any production, annual or perennial, and I'd recommend burning the holes. And I'd highly recommend if you are doing this, get like an extender handle to attach on your little propane torch. Then you don't have to bend over at all when you're burning holes. You can just stand and comfortably move. Back saver. So treat yourself to this $15 purchase. It will save you time and back pain.
Do you put in a cover crop when you take your landscape fabric out of your annual
bed? Question was, do we put in cover crops when we take off our landscape fabric? It depends. We've done a lot of different things in our annuals over the years in terms of sometimes using cover crops. We have a couple of, for our annual plantings, we have a couple of 50 by 150 silage tarps that we'll also like use that will move around. Like we've had a system the last few years of wherever we know we're going to be planting annuals in the following year, we'll kind of just let weeds grow for a little bit and then put a tarp on that area in the fall, lift that tarp up. We have just some local sources of compost and manure, so we've had cow, horse, chicken throughout the year as manure, have somebody spread manure on that, till that in, put the tarp back on, or not, depending on how late in the season it is, and then that's where we plant our annuals the next year. So it's sort of, it's varied a lot year to year in terms of how we're managing the annual production. Obviously, you could mulch with natural mulches, straw, whatever kinds of natural mulches you might be using. There's going to be benefits and drawbacks to that, too. Grass pathways, like I mentioned, I might consider that now if I was doing it now, because now I have a really nice mower and like the system is in place to actively manage more grassy pathways. So it just depends on your systems and your preferences and your equipment and your style of production. So perennial maintenance, a lot of weeding, especially in the first couple of years. There's several crops now that we don't have to weed at all anymore because they're just so well established that they outcompete the weeds immediately. But in the first couple of years especially, we're doing a lot of weeding. And especially being mindful of trying to, more perennial weeds like giant dandelions or thistle or these things that can be really hard to get rid of. This was a volunteer that we had last year who pulled out this very impressive dandelion root without breaking it and was very proud of that. So, but yeah, especially in the first couple of years, you're just going to be doing a lot of weeding. Especially with the more like woody shrub plants, the first year you plant them, the second year you plant them, it's like you literally don't even see them grow. They just sit there and you have to weed them a lot. So just be mindful that in those first couple of years, you're going to spend a lot of time weeding. But as the years have gone by, it's less and less weeding every year and it feels really good. I don't have a slide about pest management. And the reason I don't have a slide about pest management is because I'm very lucky that I haven't had to think a lot about pest management in general. People have asked over the years, like, what do you do to manage pests? And the honest answer is every time throughout the years we've seen some sort of pest in the hoop houses, the annuals, anywhere, we've gone, oh my gosh, there's this, it's gonna eat this. And then we get busy and forget about it. And then a week later, the pest is gone, or however long later. We just have, honestly, a really, really biodiverse ecosystem, and it seems like every time we have a pest, something beneficial comes and just takes care of the problem for us. So, sorry, I realize that's like I'm very privileged to say that. Sorry for everybody who's dealing with terrible pest issues. We just haven't. I will say, though, that last year, I did notice a significant amount of aphids in one area of one of our perennial fields, and I'm prepared to possibly do some spraying of neem on that section this year because we had some quality issues with that. But I haven't done that yet. I'm still deciding on it. Anyway, I don't have a whole lot to say about pest management, and I'm not going to be your go-to person on that because I just haven't had to do a lot of pest management.
So I guess not so much even about like pests, but just with even like the pollinators and other things, like when you guys are going to harvest and weed, like because you are attracting like a bunch of, you know, insects, which is good. How much, like, do you guys have to kind of really suit up because they are
sure
pollinator magnets?
Question was about how, like, do we have to, like, protect ourselves or be mindful of, like, getting stung, basically. How often do you guys feel like have you been stung much?
I think about the 4 years I've worked there, or 3 or whatever, I've gotten stung twice.
Okay. Alicia's in her fourth season this year and said she can only remember getting stung twice. I think I get stung maybe once a year. And it's usually in the fall when it's getting cold and everything's sort of like getting slow and lazy and like the bees will kind of hide under the flowers petals and you can't really see them. There's so many bees and these things around, but they kind of, I don't know, we just kind of coexist and don't really seem to bother each other. There's also just at any given time so many flowers and so much stuff that we just kind of, it hasn't been a problem.
They kind of just do their own thing.
Yeah, Johanna says they just kind of do their own thing, and so do we. So.
Could you talk about the deciding how to space your perennials? Like, are they all in the same row spacing, or depending on the variety, are they different? You know, like mm-hmm. you said, the peonies start small, and then they get huge. How did you give yourself enough, you know, space in between?
That's a really good question. He was asking about, question was about plant spacing and how do we decide plant spacing. There's a book that I have on like the your things, and that's on one of the last slides that was like my absolute like go-to manual of like deciding plant spacing when I had no idea, because every plant is different. In general, like we have everything kind of like in row, like, you know, rows, but like every plant is different. Every plant is different. So kind of a individual case by case, depending on what we're planting thing. Some things are planted very closely, you know, every couple of inches. Some things need multiple feet in between every single plant. So it kind of depends a lot.
And if I could just say again, not so much between plants in the row, but like mm-hmm. between rows for you to walk.
Okay, sure. So, question about how much space in between rows. Also, kind of depends, varies depending on what we're planting, but like minimum 2 feet, I would say, because that just, even with things that aren't going to get too huge, that's enough room for a comfortable walking path. In general, with both our annuals and perennials, we try to leave as little space as possible. And even if you're looking up like different crops and like how, what kind of spacing they want, like if you're looking at sources that are more geared towards like gardeners and stuff, you'll often find like recommendations for a lot of space in between things. And we found in general that we can push things a lot closer to maximize that space, get longer stems even that way with both perennials and annuals. So, but yeah, it's kind of a case by case, depending on what the crop is. Perennial maintenance in terms of pruning, cleaning, debudding. This is also going to be a kind of a, like every individual flower crop is going to be different, and we won't have time to really talk about any individual ones. But in general, like the tools that we use our Felco pruners is what we use for harvesting flowers throughout the season, and we also use those for like smaller pruning jobs. A couple years ago, I got myself a battery-operated hedge trimmer, which has been like one of the biggest time and energy saving tools that I have. I use this, I don't have a tractor anymore. In general, like we don't do tractor tilling or anything like that. So everything on the farm is like small hand tools or like small scale machinery. So this we actually use to cut down our some of our field annuals as well before we take the landscape fabric off. So we use this battery operated hedge trimmer for like some pruning. If things are like have thicker stalks that I can't get to with that, I've just used the chainsaw on the willows that turned into trees that I couldn't get to cut down any other way. It's not really the most ideal tool because it's like such a jagged cut. It's not like a smooth cut. It's a very aggressive sort of tool, but I have used a chainsaw in some kind of last ditch pruning emergencies. Also summer versus fall. We prune some things in the fall, some things in the summer. A lot of that is just like what we have time to get to, and then the rest waits till spring. I know people have a lot of preferences on that, spring versus fall. We've done some of each. Some things we don't have to specifically go back and prune or cut because the way that we're harvesting them is basically pruning them at the same time. So trying to think about that, like for example, with like things like the willow and dogwood, when we don't really need stems that are 12 feet long, but we have to cut them down anyway. So when we're harvesting that, we're cutting them down to where we would want them for pruning them. Somebody has a question? Yep, so we do, we have like occasionally if there is like a space out in the field or in the hoops that really needs to like that soil to be worked more, we'll have like somebody else come and do some tractor tilling. But for the most part, adding compost, broad forking.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Fertilizer. The 824, I don't remember offhand like what the NPK is that we use, but we use Sustain fertilizer. We use that for everything, for annuals and perennials. We just found it's like a nice quality, easy to use granular fertilizer, so we use that for everything. We fertilize all of our perennials in the spring. We just walk around and spread the fertilizer around, you know, around the roots. And then we've also used like Neptune Harvest with a backpack sprayer, doing foliar feeds on the perennials as well. I don't really have like a very organized schedule for that. I'd like to do better on that, but every year in the spring, Usually we'll do like a early spring weeding if we need to for what needs to be weeded, and then we'll do a fertilizer. We've sometimes fertilized in the fall as well, but always in the spring for sure. Question was, where do we source the fertilizer? We get our fertilizer and our potting soil from Sioux Growing Supply in Wausau. Let's see. Harvest, post-harvest. This is another situation where, like every flower crop, annual and perennial, you're gonna have a different different things you'll need to know in terms of when to harvest, what stage of harvest, all the things. So case by case basis, but in general, harvesting, like the same as any annual crops, any flower crops in general, like harvesting out of the heat of the day, so in the morning or the evening. We harvest in the morning because that's when I have a crew. Getting stems in water, you know, certain things somebody asked earlier about, like searing the ends or different things like that for certain crops. But in general, cutting when it's not hot, knowing the right stage of harvest, getting things in water. A lot of people in here are already growing flowers, so you already know how important clean buckets and clean water are. We wash all of our buckets after every use, so all the buckets are clean all the time. We have a walk-in cooler where we store all of our flowers, both annual and perennial. Everything goes in the same cooler. I used to fuss a lot about the temperature of the cooler, and like, I don't know. I mean, there's some crops that really want it to be colder, like 34 or 36. Some crops that want it to be a little bit warmer, 45, 50. We kind of keep our cooler around 42 degrees. Almost everything that we're harvesting is being sold the next day or maybe 2 days after we harvest it. So we don't really need perfect conditions for everything. We just need like good enough conditions for everything. So I kind of like the cooler at 42-ish degrees. We also generally, whether like it's wholesale or for farmers market, everything gets harvested into a clean bucket, clean water, goes into the cooler, and then when we're taking it out to organize in the van for wholesale or making our market bouquets or whatever we're doing, everything gets in a different clean bucket, clean water before it leaves the farm. Oh, and this is just our we have a Kawasaki mule that we use for everything. We put the weeds in. This is what we load up with buckets when we're harvesting, how we get ourselves around all over the place. This is like our utility vehicle. We don't have a farm truck or anything, so this is like our everything. So that's basically the end. This is the stuff that you already have on your lists. This is far from an exhaustive list, but these are some perennials that we have had success growing from seed in zone 4. Some others that I put on the worth a shot category, things that have not worked for us, they have not liked our soil, our growing conditions, been a little bit too cold, but things that you can grow in zone 4 that just haven't worked for us, but certainly worth a try. And then things that we've grown from roots, plants, or cuttings, that have worked well for us, and some others worth a try. And then where we've sourced, so like our some of our favorite seed sources and some of our favorite sources for plants, roots, cuttings. This book on the left, I mentioned the question about plant spacing. Both these books are expensive. But I've used both of these books. They've been like invaluable resources for me. I don't know if anybody else has used these books, but when we were in like the winter 2017-2018, we were planning our original like bigger perennial planting, I obsessively read this book like over and over and over. It's how I learned how I decided what to grow, what like some of the better varieties to grow. It also has information in there about just like plant maintenance, pruning, marketability, how many stems you can expect to yield from any given plant and how long it'll take you to get to that point. Just all the information that you could need to know about woody cut stems in that book. This book on the right, I also use not just for perennials, but for annuals too, in terms of like specific, this is geared towards more conventional growers, so it has a lot of recommendations too in terms of like what holding solutions to use and things like that, which we don't use any of that stuff, but also just has really good advice for like storage and harvest stage and all that stuff for flowers, both annual and perennial. Some other resources, I'm a member of the Association of Specialty Cut Flower Growers, the ASCFG. When I was first starting to grow flowers, I didn't know anybody who was growing flowers. Now I know a lot of people who are growing flowers. Like in my region, I have friends that I can see and meet with and know, and that I sell the two through TCFE with, or just that I've met in various places. But first starting out, I didn't know anybody. I learned a lot from joining the ASCFG in the beginning. I've been to a couple of their, they have annual conventions, I've been to a couple of them. There's also just a lot of flower farming Facebook groups. The first couple of years that we were growing flowers, I spent a lot of time in the winter just using the search feature in various flower farming Facebook groups to find answers to like literally every question I had. Slow Flowers, we're also a member of that organization. It's an organization, they also have annual get-togethers, and there's a podcast. The No-Till Flowers podcast, probably some good information generally about perennials in there and just flowers in general. And just finding, obviously, flower friends in your area. This is the last slide. This is my contact information. And then I was going to ask if anybody has, like, when I was, had, like, the... If anybody has any other recommendations of like seed or plant sources and they want to like shout them out so people can know and write them down if they want?
So I got a list. One thing to keep in mind is like who you sell to. So we sell the higher end weddings. So some of this may not be applicable if you're looking for a market. But one's called a nursery called Willow Bend out of Ohio.
So Willow Bend out of Ohio.
They're now by owned by the Petiti. If you have a minimum order of $3,500, so
minimum order $3,500.
If you have a group buy, their pricing is really good. So they have 5 gallon bare roots for like the $5 and $7, $9 per range. So it's pretty good pricing, and you can do a group buy on that. Walter's Garden in Michigan.
Walter's Garden, I've also bought from them before too. I don't have them on this list, but
Some awesome sedums, Baptisia, Hellebore, Miscanthus, Flax, Salvia, Veronica. Some really cool stuff from them. Edney Flower Bulb, they sell bare root perennials.
Edney, yes, actually, so they were bought out right by Ball Seed.
You buy from Ball, but
yeah.
So
say that one again.
Edney, so it's E-D-N-I-E.
Gully Greenhouse, they're also by Ball. They have some lupine, the West Country series.
Ooh.
Worth looking at.
Can you repeat the name of that one again?
Gully Greenhouse.
Gully Greenhouse.
North Creek Nursery by Ball, they sell different mountain mint varieties.
North Creek Nursery, mountain mint, thank you for that.
Pizzo Plant Nursery. They're also
Pizzo Plant Nursery?
They also have mountain mint.
Okay.
Botanical Trading Company, Co Flavor, they do Ilex.
Botanical Trading Company. I was going to say, too, we have each other's contact. So you all have my contact now. If anybody here wants to, contact me, if you have, like, other sources you think of or you just want to receive other sources, you can email me. I could create, like, a group email and just send out, like, additional resources. If people are interested in that, we can coordinate that. So.
Can you put your contact back up there?
Yes. Oh, yeah. Oh, sorry. Go ahead. I don't remember for sure. I don't know for sure. It's from Sioux Growing Supply, their mix. I don't know if it has peat in it or not. If it does, it's a small amount.
It does.
It does? Okay. Awesome. Okay, so she's got done taking Florette's, of course, says it was worth the money, and that you also have access to the resources from that forever. I know also, Growers Workshop. Is that somebody help me out? Anybody know? What?
Gardener's Workshop.
She's amazing. I've met her in real life, and she does Gardener's Workshop. Also has some like resources on like YouTube, things you can access for free. Also some courses. Sunny Meadows Flower Farm in Ohio. I have visited their farm at an ASCFG tour, and they're probably the farm that I've most looked up to in my farm journey. And they also have some educational programs and classes that they offer as well. Okay. Awesome. McHenry Cut Flowers Growing School.
So, Ball Seed, how do you order from them? Like, do you have to be a member or something?
A question was about how to order from Ball Seed. I believe you have to make an account through them, and then you'll have like a customer service person who's assigned to you and who will send you varieties and price lists and all those things. But you do have to make an account through them.
But it's free to do
that? It is free to make the account. Mm-hmm.
The gentleman that was giving us the resources, was it Botanical
Trading Company?
Botanical Trading Company.
Correct. Co-Flavor, K-O-K-L-A-V-E-R.
Did you have any more on your list? I don't know if you got cut off. Okay, awesome. Okay. Go ahead.
All of your perennials that you can see, you started those all in the greenhouse, or were any of them direct sown?
Question was about how did we direct seed or start in the greenhouse all of our perennials that we grew from seed? All of them started in the greenhouse. I've never done any direct seeding with perennials. A lot of them seem to just grow slowly and take longer to germinate overall compared to annual seeds, so I think I would always start them in the greenhouse. A question was, how big are the holes that we burn? In our annuals, it's probably like 2.5 inches. For perennials, bigger. I don't even know how big. I'm trying to think For the things that are like the woody shrub crops, maybe like this-ish, maybe even a little bit bigger. So it sort of depends. Things that we started from seed, like yarrow, for example, not quite that big.
But don't you have to go back, every couple of years or every year and like make your hole bigger, especially for yarrow?
Yes. Peonies, I think, remember last year we extended the holes on those? I think it was maybe the woofer who did that. And the peonies, I remember last year we did have to go through and extend the holes a little bit on those. I don't know, it's kind of like for some things, it might have been better to start with smaller holes because we would have done less weeding. There are certain things that we made the holes pretty big from the beginning, and maybe we shouldn't have because the labor of expanding the holes would have been a lot less than the labor we spent for like 4 years pulling a lot of weeds out of holes that were too big. So I don't know that. but something to kind of, depending on what plant and how big, if it's something that you just have little plugs or something that immediately you're starting with a big plant, you have to have a bigger hole. It's going to vary plant by plant. Like some things are going to grow, are going to flower off of like the new growth. Some things flower off like the last year's growth. That's something that that book that I referenced has information on that for every type of plant. So it sort of depends. And there's certain things too where you can do different styles of pruning depending on like hydrangea. Maybe you want to have some smaller flowers and some bigger flowers, so you might do like different types of pruning in the same planting to have different sizes of flowers for different things. Can you repeat that? Thank you for that. Any other questions? We're just about out. We have like 2 minutes left if anybody has another question.
Is this your only job?
a question was, is this my only job?
Just off your flowers.
So from 2015 or 2016 to 2020, it was my only job when I was farming with a partner. He had an off-farm job for the first 2 years, and then we farmed just solely farmed for 3 years. After then going through the very expensive divorce and buying out process, I bartend a couple nights a week but the farm still is the majority of my income. It pays for all the bills and all the basic living expenses, and then I work a little bit off farm for just sort of a little bit of extra financial security and everything else in life that you want to pay for. So, but it is the bulk of my income. Mm-hmm.